Hi. I mean, my first and only official officious action of the day. I am State Representative Erin Murphy from 64A in St. Paul. And I am here today with my friend and colleague, Representative Erin Murphy.
Actually,
you
live 3 miles away from me. When we look outside, you'll see this great little road that's winding around. Wildlife rate with no public access. And 300-acre farm.
Well, that's me. We're really, really delighted to be here today to talk about pharmacy reimbursement, especially in the medical assistance program, and the effects that will occur once the federal changes take place early next year. And I want to say that Mary Ellen and I both serve on, Representative O'Connor and I both serve on the Health and Human Services Policy Committee, and we worked on this issue last session and did not make all the headway that we wanted to. And we thought that it would be really important to be able to bring to the Capitol stories from folks that are going to be dealing with this, particularly in Greater Minnesota, to help us better advocate for the protection that we think that you're going to need when it comes to reimbursement in the medical assistance program. And that's why we're here today, really to get your perspective on the issue of the federal change and more generally on reimbursement, if you have perspectives to share. Our goal is to bring the information back from this hearing, and we're going to do one or two more hearings in Greater Minnesota. To be able to take that information back to our committee and to the Healthcare Access Commission and feed that into the work that we're doing on healthcare reform or transformation overall. So we're thrilled that you're here and thank you for coming. We're going to do some introductions, and then essentially we're going to turn the floor over to you. We're recording the meeting, but we don't have to pass the mic around. But know that we're recording so that we capture the information well, and so speak. You know, if we can do one at a time, I think it'll make it just a little easier for the recording process. We'll probably meet for about an hour. When we're done, I know we're going to take a tour of a pharmacy in the area. And in follow-up, if you have thoughts or questions, certainly you can bring those to Representative Okemba as your representative, and you can send them my way as well by email or call. We want to try and make sure we understand what you're facing, and we hope that we're able to bring some relief down the line. So with that, if you could just take a spin around the room, tell us a little bit about yourself and what you do.
I'm Jennifer McNartney. I'm the Health and Human Services Policy Committee Administrator, and so I am going to be staffing this working group, and if you all have any questions at the end or need contact information, let me know.
Hi, I'm Nate Seif, and I'm Seif Drug, and I've got 7 pharmacies range from Moorhead to the northwest down to Henning at the southeast.
Amy Bolt, I'm a P4 pharmacy intern from NDSU. I'm on rotation with Nate.
Good. I'm Jeff Sawyer. I'm co-owner of Melrose Pharmacy. We're the only pharmacy in Melrose. We service the vet clinic, nursing home, hospital, and the pharmacy, retail pharmacy.
I'm Dan Popowski, and I'm a P4 pharmacy student also, and right now I'm at Mutual Wolf Drug with Jennifer in Little Falls.
Welcome.
My name is Amanda Meyer. I am a P4 and DSU student as well, and right now I am with Christine at St. Gabriel's Hospital Pharmacy.
I'm Christine Petoka. I am at St. Gabriel's Hospital.
I'm Jennifer Hagan, and I'm with St. Wolf's
Mutual Drug in Little Falls. I'm Lonnie Londo
Roberts from St. Paul. We
own
4 pharmacies, and Abel,
Motley,
Wilshire, and
then
Staples Clinic.
I'm John Kavanaugh, formerly from Fergus Falls, but now from St. Paul with Cushville Gerard.
Back in the corner.
I'm Jason Brown, publisher of Long Haler.
Okay, thank you.
Mark from Drug, based in Alexandria. We own 5 pharmacies in the Alexandria area, and medication therapy management. service and home health, durable medical equipment business.
I'm Kevin Dahl from Long Prairie, Minnesota. I had my own store here for 10 years, sold out to Colburn's. I work next door, been in the community and in rural Minnesota for the last 15 years.
I'm Mike Barrett. I'm the director of pharmacy at Long Prairie Memorial Hospital here. I've been there for 20 years.
Gary Baylor. I'm executive VP of pharmacy operations for Tracy White. We have 49 stores in Minnesota, scattered north, south, east, and west. Very rural.
I'm Lynn Carpenter with Minnesota Pharmacy.
I'm Dan Holland from DFL House Research. So I staff the entire DFL caucus on health and human services and policy issues.
I think that means we're not going to do that again. So, just a brief question to the P4. P4, in the, how many years?
Six.
So you're in the fourth
professional year.
Okay.
You've been graduating in
May. Fabulous.
There's two pre-pharmacy years and there's four pharmacy years. So that means P4 means they're in their sixth year.
I'm also a registered nurse, so I am familiar with the educational preparation there, but not as much as a pharmacist. It's helpful to know. I hope you practice in Minnesota.
Well, I probably could say that I've been on the Health and Health Human Services Committee for 10 years. So my focus is in rural health, and it's always having to look at the rural side of everything for me. I really appreciate the number of you coming here to tell us your story. It is so important to know what we want to have in this rural piece with Medicare. You know, when I'm out and about in my area so many times, a couple times I ran into pharmacists who were telling their sons not for a diet, not to go into this because of what's happening out in Rome in terms of the reimbursement. So I'm just excited about having all of you here in the rural areas. It's an honor to have you here.
I'm glad to hear you say that it's very difficult to get time off from a rural pharmacy to be able to get in here to present most.
Yeah, we're also delighted, and you know, we were happy to see when we made the arrangements to come that there were a number of people that were going to come from the area. This is not the only work that we're doing in rural health. The full committee is going to be doing some hearings in Greater Minnesota, and there's a lot of work. We'll be in Little Falls. And that'll be in October 19th, I believe. We'll have a hearing in Little Falls to talk about rural health more broadly. So not just specifically this issue. But this one, you know, we understand the importance of, you know, obviously the importance of pharmacy in the context of healthcare delivery and the importance of pharmacy to community and the fabric of a rural community. And then we target that by eliminating or making it difficult for important segments like a pharmacy to remain. We target the community of Minnesota. So that's why we thought it was important to come here. And I know a lot of people are able to come down to the Capitol during sessions, but we think it's important that we come out as well. So thanks for taking your time. I get as a nurse who's worked in a rural community before how hard it is to get away. So I would like to know from you, who would like to begin?
I'll start.
I thought so.
I did a lot of preparation for this because for every one of us in this room today, this is important. I've been in retail pharmacy for 37 years. The last 24 have been in management and upper management. So I think, and I'm a numbers guy, I like numbers, so I think we have a real good handle on what's happening. And if I get wordy, just cut me off or somebody else has something else to say. But folks, this is your time to get up, stand up, and shout your message to these two people from St. Paul, that are coming here to listen to us today. And if we sit back and do nothing, we're going to get steamrolled again like pharmacy has for the last 23 years since PBMs really came into existence and third party happened. When I got out of pharmacy school, NDSU, by the way, 1970, 95% of our business was cash, 5% was Medicaid, there was no third party. PBMs came into play about 1983 when PCS was first set up as a means of helping insurers build plans. They were not a PBM, they were a PBA, a pharmacy benefit administrator. All of a sudden they saw the money and the rebates that can be derived by putting together formularies and everything else. And today we have what's evolved with all of the big players out there, Express Scripts, PCS, PharmaCare, Medco, and now even our state Medicaids have gotten into the program of being stuck on rebate. It's like a bad addiction. And I told Senator Murphy a little bit earlier, before the meeting started, until this model is broken and we cut the addiction to rebates, which seems to be the end-all, drive-all, we will sit here 10 years from now. I won't be. I'm going to be retired. But some of you will. We're going to have the same issues that we have today, and that is going to be, how do you control this runaway spend on prescription drugs? And folks, we are the low-hanging fruit. Every time there's a cut to be made, who do they look for? It's the pharmacy provider. Every single time. And it happens with Blue Cross and Prime Therapeutics. It happens with Medco. It happens with PCS. It happens with Medicaid. I have some numbers that I will share with you today and point that out. I love to do numbers and I love to do analyses. And from those analyses come facts, not fiction, nothing that's made up or trumped up. These are actual numbers taken from our stores. So I just think we need to really speak up. And what's happening to us is we are all being driven out of business. And I told Senator Murphy before this meeting today, when this AMP thing comes into play, it's a very simple business decision for me. When I see red ink flowing from when we fill a prescription, and it costs us money, I'm out of the program. It's that simple. And that's the message that Chris Young and the commissioner of DHS need to hear. They don't think we're going to do it. I can't speak for all of you because that's collusion, and we're not going to get going on that today. But I will tell you, from my 49 stores that I supervise in Minnesota, I'm out of the program. I simply am not going to fill prescriptions. I'm better off doing less business, laying off some help, and making the existing profits that we make with less business.
Mr. Bullard, first of all, for interest, you're all welcome to call me Aaron if you want. It's a lot easier than all that type of stuff. I'm wondering if you could describe a little bit about the process for you within the context of the Medicaid program and filling prescriptions, sort of the funding process, right? So you're talking a lot about the rebate. And if you could just share with us, one of the things I'm learning, and I'm a freshman in the legislature, although a fair amount of experience still into this process, and different providers are reimbursed in different ways. And I think the way pharmacies are reimbursed is complicated, right? And so if you could maybe just talk about it from your perspective,
that would,
I think, help all of us kind of get on one stage. And then if people have, you know, a perspective that's different from that, if you could.
The funding for the reimbursement of pharmacy is complicated if you don't understand it. I have a good handle on it. I think many of you in this room probably do because you can sleep and breathe it every day. But basically, there are two classifications of drugs. There are brand name drugs and there are generics. The brand name drugs are discounted from the average wholesale price, which is a number that was set up by the manufacturers years and years ago. And from that amount, the plans over the years have discounted that average wholesale price to get to what they think is very close to our actual acquisition cost. So once that discounted AWP is determined, then there's a dispensing fee added to that. And in Minnesota, which is one of my states, that have this, there is also a 2% Medicare tax, which is a wholesale distribution tax, that is not reimbursed by the state. So right now the formula for state Medicaid in Minnesota is average wholesale price minus 12%, which really translates into 14%, because we are required to pay that into the state, but it is not a pass-through tax for the state or for any Medicare prescriptions. So we eat that 2% tax. And the dispensing fee, help me out, 365? 365, okay. Yeah. So we get AWB minus 12%, minus another 2% for the Medicare tax, plus 365. Then on the generic side, generics can be priced a couple of different ways. One is to do an average wholesale price and discount that. But because the spread between the cost and the average wholesale price on generics is all over the board, third-party plans have really chosen to use what they call maximum allowable cost or max pricing. And so in Minnesota, the state has its own MAC list. They do not follow the federal upper limit or the FUL for the guidelines. They use their own MAC list, which is very expansive, and it's a very aggressive price list. In fact, one of the comments that Chris Young had made, and I think I probably heard that from Liz, one of the comments she made was that she didn't feel that the Minnesota MAC list was any more aggressive than maybe 15% less than what the federal upper limit. So, me being a curious kind of guy and liking numbers, I just went to the Minnesota website and randomly selected 350 generic items. And I just took one of each of everything, and commonly used things that are going to impact every one of us in this room today. And when I got all done, the real difference was 48%, not 15%. So, and I can also substantiate that I have tracked the reimbursement for state Medicaid by month since November of 2002. So I am looking at probably $100 million worth of sales. So again, I've got a very broad perspective in this, and these are accurate numbers. But when I look at what our gross profit dollars are per prescription today compared to what they were 3 years, 4 years, or 5 years ago, it is running upwards of $3 less. And here's one of the real dichotomies that we all face today with the prices that keep rising for the Medicaid prescription drug program. We should be focused in on generics because a generic runs about 20% of the average prescription price of a brand name drug. In our pharmacies, for our 49 that we have in the state, our average generic prescription price for Medicaid runs somewhere around $20. On the other side, on the brand side, it's over 100. Yet we're being forced by the way the program is being run today, with the max being cut and cut and cut all the time, we're really being disincentivized to use generics, and almost we should be calling the doctors and asking them to prescribe brand name drugs, which is exactly what will drive the prices up even further. We haven't done that, and I don't think anybody in this room does, because there are too many other hoops to jump through with prior authorizations and everything else. But the program, the way it's set up today, is just backwards. And the inflation that we are seeing will never, never go away until this model changes. The one piece I don't know a lot about with the state is the rebates that they get from the giant pharmaceutical manufacturer, Big Pharma, we call it. I know last year it was about $67 million, but I don't know how that was paid, what the formulas are, and how much of those drugs that are being rebated today could really be shifted over to another generic drug, either in the same class or maybe a similar therapeutic class.
Great.
just because a patient is on Paxil or whatever it is today doesn't mean there's not another drug in a similar class that couldn't be used that would be just as effective. And there are countless examples there of drugs that have gone off patent and it's become generic. I don't know that anybody takes a hard look at that. And I just think the mindset right now is so stuck on rebates that until that changes, we're never, never, never going to solve the problem. But if a few people with the experience that I've got and all of you around this table have, we are smart enough to sit down and figure it out. But we need to force the issue, and somebody's got to tell our commissioner it's time for a change. Change this model because it's never going to go away. And it's the same thing in North Dakota, it's the same thing in Iowa, it's wherever we have our stores. It's the same model. But you've got to break that mold.
Are there others with a perspective on this then?
I just want to say the pharmacists are left to police this as well. The physician may or may not know the 20 different formularies out there, and they will write for whatever they think is necessary, and it's left to pharmacists to take their time to get back to the physicians depending on, you know, the appropriate therapy based off of what the PBM decides is appropriate for a patient as opposed to what may or may not be. I don't know if that makes sense.
We are the police, men and women.
We're here to ask you to rescue us again. And I'm sick of that and I wish we could change it. But we had a rural crisis with attracting pharmacists to rural areas. And the legislators came, and I thank you for that, for rescuing us and half of the rural loan forgiveness. Three of the last pharmacists we hired have qualified for the rural loan forgiveness. And you helped us with that. Medicare Part D came along a few years ago, and we weren't getting paid, and you rescued us from that. Now we're going to be selling generic drugs for less than it costs us, according to the federal regulations, and we need rescuing from that. And if we don't, we're going out of business, or we're not going to provide service to your clients. It's that simple. I don't have all the numbers, but I just know it isn't going to work. Like, it's written down, and I'm thanking you for what you've done in the past, and I hope you can see our predicament in the future. And Gary's right, we need to change the system, but that isn't going to happen by the time this is in effect. We need rescue.
And if I can add to that, the thing that's going to happen, like in our setting, is the people that are going to be hurt are your nursing home patients, your elderly, your lower income. Because those are the ones that are going to have to travel, which is an issue for them anyway, to find service. You know, I mean, the greatest majority of our medical assistance in our setting in Stearns County is nursing home, or low income, or children with issues or, you know, medical problems. Those are the ones that are going to be hurt.
And again, it comes down to the rural access issue, because one of our pharmacies is the only pharmacy in town, and a couple of our other pharmacies, there's about two pharmacies in town. But, you know, if one of our pharmacies is the only pharmacist in that town decides not to serve Medicaid patients, there's going to be a rural access issue. And I'm sure Gary's aware of that too, is there, you know, a lot of their stores are rural stores, and I'm not sure how many of them are single pharmacy towns.
11 or 12 of
them. Yeah. That, you know, you can't afford to, you know, no volume is going to make up for losing dollars. We can't make, in the past it's always been, oh, you can make up for your cuts by increasing volume and baby boomers and all this stuff. Well, when you start talking about losses, you can't make it up in volume.
And the ramifications of that, I'm sure in your 11 or 12 stores, like our store, we are the only pharmacy in town, but we service the hospital. Well, if we disappear, then there's nobody to service that hospital either. We've got the largest vet clinic in the state of Minnesota. We do that via telepharmacy. If we don't do that, they're going to have to search for a pharmacist to do that as well. We're an outreach pharmacy for the Centricare health system, like you are, so we do chemotherapy. We do anti-coag therapy. We do, you know, it's just a broad spectrum of what we cover in the rural area. So if we go away, those ramifications affect other healthcare issues.
you know, it's not just a matter of having a body there, it's a matter of the skill set. It takes a little different skill set to do, you know, to do retail and hospital because it's so much different.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so, you know, you're not just losing the site, you're losing the skill sets too.
And another thing to think about in as far as reimbursement goes, I have a pharmacist. I'm working for a pharmacist who would like to retire in 2 years. He would like me to buy his store from him, but I can't at this point really think about buying the store if I don't think I'm going to have a business worthy of taking over in the future. So this is one of the reasons why I'm here, because I like pharmacy and I want to continue to work in the rural pharmacy and possibly buy these pharmacies in the future. So,
the General Accounting Office, arm of the federal government, did a study. They estimated that the cost for a pharmacy to provide products would be, on average, 36% below their cost of procurement. I took that list of drugs, and I took that a little bit further, and I broke it out by item movement, because that was a general average. And when I took our store's movement, which is going to reflect very similarly with all these other stores here today, the cost differential was actually 58%. Because it's based on the fastest moving stuff and the phenolols and the simvastatins that we dispense. They took the big picture, I narrowed it down to actually what's going to affect us and our store and all of you here today. And it was really 58%. So now the numbers get worse. The other thing that I wanted to mention, and Liz, if I'm wrong, correct me, but I think Chris Young had made the statement that her plan for the state was to use Minnesota MAC, AMP, or submitted cost, whichever was the least costly. So now she's using Minnesota MAC, which is very, very aggressive already, or AMP, which could be still lower. So that's going to depress it even further. So that 58%, that may be a little bit understated as well. And I don't know that for sure, but I'm just presupposing here.
And it goes back, just, I guess, to my presentation here from House File 297, which is the end of this HHS bill. And they are using 36% as the figure.
But that is not...
No, I know, but I mean, so they're Minnesota, yeah, but I'm just saying, you know, according to the HF 297 last year, that 36 is what the state's using the figure on.
Is that the fiscal analysis that you're looking at?
I just got a summary of the bill and all the systems.
I'm wondering if, I'm wondering if you could share a little bit with us about the concentration of your business with Medicaid, Medicare. How much of your business is that? You know, I'm trying to understand the impact this might have on rural communities. It's helpful to know, not necessarily the percentage, but the reach of this change and what it could do to your ability to provide care.
I can start out again. Prior to Medicare Part D, our total Medicaid population was something around 17-18% of the total number of prescriptions that we filled. Not dollars, but script count. After Medicare Part D, there was a bigger swing with the dual eligible recipients than I thought there was going to be. So our Medicaid population right now is probably around 7%. It's quite about 10%, 10-11% flop the other way to Medicare Part D. But 7, and that's an average, it's going to vary by pocket. So I don't know how that, you know, ties
well,
into your numbers, Mark.
It varies by location.
It does.
Like, for instance, our Park Victoria location is the service nursing home there, and it's high percentage of
yes.
Medicaid. And it's not so much what it means to my business, but what it means to the clients.
Right.
You know, if I lost my Medicaid business in that single pharmacy town, I doubt I could do business there. But all the patients that we serve wouldn't have a pharmacy to serve them locally, anyway.
Yeah, and that's the same for us in Madison, Minnesota, where we do a lot of nursing home business, and there is a high Medicaid population.
Right. I mean, I think one of the, you know, we worked in a lot of pharmacies. Talked about last session on this piece of legislation to try and shift the dispensing fee to try and balance this, right? And I think one of the arguments that I heard from people who didn't think that this was necessary at this time was, you know, it's such a small slice of business that it, you know, it's not going to have the impact that you're expecting, that I'm suggesting to others, that it won't hurt rural pharmacies because, you know, it's not that big a part of the population, not that big of a part of the business. And I want to be able to bring information back to county that. And I think it is clear to me, the pharmacists that I've talked with, that we need to attend to this issue. But we've been having some difficulty convincing, frankly, the administration that it is important that we attend to this issue. And I think it's because my inclination is to try and stop the problem before it starts. And I think there's some wait-and-see attitude coming from the department. And so I think it's important that we, you know, that I am able to bring back good, concrete information about the impact. Certainly we are concerned and do not want people in nursing homes, kids with conditions that are from low-income families. We don't want those people to go without medication. That's not going to help the state of Minnesota. It's not going to help the people that live in Minnesota. So I think it's important that, you know, we are able to talk about the ramifications in human terms, and I appreciate that.
Jeff really hit the nail on the head when he said it just isn't about our patients that walk into our stores.
Right.
We do telepharmacy. We have 4 telepharmacies in Minnesota. We service 14,000 nursing home beds in Minnesota and North Dakota, and many of those patients are Medicaid. I don't know, has anybody talked to administrators of nursing homes or directors of nursing to find out what their thoughts are, and have they been able to express their concerns to DHS about what's going to happen here?
The biggest concern, like, we're a campus, we have a clinic, a hospital, and a nursing home. And where we have the majority of our clients in the nursing home go to the retail end, we have a significant percentage that are on short-term stays or rehab, and we get capitated payments as the Medicare A-covered people. And we're given, you know, a fixed amount of money to provide the care, the supplies, and the medications for these people. Okay, and so since that is considered under the own use provisions, we do that ourselves as a cost savings. And we can buy significantly cheaper on bid as a nonprofit than Kevin can buy at cost in the store. If they go away and we're forced to do it, then we have to re-license, we have to carry a hold of the inventories. You know, it creates a huge problem. If we start losing the personnel and the skill sets we have there, then the hospital has to go to retail and increase their cost 3 or 4-fold. So it's a double-edged sword either way, no matter which side of the equation you're on in nursing homes. You know, because you're probably running upwards of 80% Medicaid. You know, and it's very, very difficult because there's a lot of time, it has to be unit dose, there's a lot of requirements as far as counseling and stuff like that goes. It's actually quite a burden on the rural pharmacy to provide personals, but they do it generally to people in private community. And so what happens is then you go to where you get allied services that may be 40 to 60 miles away. You need a pill for, you know, you need order the pill started now, or you're going to get it. You know, then you need your emergency drug supplies to stay more than much, but you're allowed by 10 drugs. You know, so then it goes back to pushing that. There's other regulations need to be changed. So it's a snowball. I mean, everything comes back right back around to no matter what you do. You know, you've got to look at it. And the thing is that, you know, I've always argued that what we see, maybe not so much right here, but you get northwestern Minnesota, a lot of these towns aren't appointments. The rural pharmacies are the primary point of health care access for people. You know, and if you get to the point where, and it's not just Medicaid, it's a lot of other pressures. There's reimportation, which I'll talk about in a minute. You know, that when you start losing these rural pharmacies, what we end up doing is we're decreasing the access of people in Minnesota to good health care, which is the exact opposite of what we want to try and do. We want to find ways to increase access to health care. Because we know overall, if you get good access to health care, you decrease the cost to the state government because they get wellness care. It's not always when they hit the emergency rooms. The other problem that we're facing, too, that needs to be addressed by HHS, which is a little bit off what we're talking today, is reimportation. Reimportation basically is here to stay. I mean, no matter how much we want to complain about it, we understand that it's here to stay.
But the problem we have is that we have small pharmacies cannot compete with re-importers. You know, and so there's competitive pressures there. The other problem is that for the state, untold millions of dollars in extra cost because, you know, the thing like 6 or 7% of the drugs we import in Minnesota come to the state website where we have, you know, inspected, certified foreign wholesalers. The rest of them are coming in. We don't know. A lot of them are counterfeit. They contain a little narcotic drug. Some are contaminated with Chinese, like Chinese type medicine with heavy metals. You know, so we don't have a safe medicine supply coming in. This leads to medication misadventures, a dramatic increase in hospitalizations, costing tens of millions of dollars extra for the state. You know, and so there's all these other allied things that go on there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so the thing is, the first, you know, and what we're faced here with, what you're going to be faced with is a limited pool of money. So the thing is, you either re-increase what you pay the pharmacy to keep them open, or you decrease the cost that you have to pay for medication.
Mm-hmm.
And my recommendation, I talked to a lot of people about that, is that we have the administration, upon the recommendation of the legislature, go to FDA and set up a pilot program whereby we can have a set number of rural pharmacists in Minnesota use these certified and inspected foreign wholesalers to re-import drugs. Now we solved all our issues. Basically, now we can guarantee the safety of the medicine supply so that the HHS is saving tens of millions of dollars that they can turn around and reapply back to reimbursing pharmacies to help keep them open. You know, the pharmacies for the non-Medicaid people now can sell drugs to their local community at prices competitive with re-imports. But as a professional pharmacist, the most important thing to me is when you re-import, you lose that pharmacist-patient relationship. So you don't take drugs that can harm or kill you. And if you can get a pilot program, a rural pharmacy can sell these drugs and with a disincentive then to re-import, now you've reestablished that pharmacist-patient relationship. So that the patient's not taking drugs that will harm themselves. You increase hospitalizations. Plus, the state pays significantly less money for drugs, which allows them then to turn around and increase the fees of pharmacists for filling. So, you know, it's not just a one-bullet solution.
Mm-hmm. And we can explore that some more. I was under the impression that Part B did take care of some of the issues of reimportation.
But if you're under Medicare age, it doesn't take care of those issues.
Okay.
Yeah. And no, Medicare B takes care of that. I mean, but if you're under 62, reimportation is still a huge issue. So.
Hold on. Yeah.
Go ahead.
I just want to ask a question. You know that there's 58% or whatever it is. What is the number for the metro area? But it has to be a different percentage, right?
Percentage.
When you were looking at cost analysis and losses.
Well, that 58% below our cost of procurement is on our entire book of business.
Right, but what is that number to the metro pharmacy?
We don't have any stores inside the 494 security. We are outside
St.
Michael.
I mean,
that number as a grand total, Mary Ellen, will be less.
Right, and that's
because I think the Medicaid population is probably not as high, except again in certain pockets of the metro.
Right,
because that is. It's no secret that we have to fight a little harder for rural. Dan knows that. I mean, it's pockets all
there,
the time.
There's one other thing.
That's the problem.
Well, one of the issues is rural is small.
Exactly.
And
it's
some of these pricing issues have to do, well, even with when they're talking about the federal anyway, they pick the lowest price ever that anybody can ever find on a generic, and they use that price.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they're basing this on, is the lowest price that we can find nationwide is what we're going to base our price on. Well, we're competing with mail-order pharmacies.
Mm-hmm.
Nationwide mail-order pharmacies, you're asking a single store, rural provider, to compete with a national mail-order pharmacy on cost.
Right.
There's no way that we can buy for what they can.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And that's what they're basing its reimbursement on. And so that's the issue with rural versus, it's not so much urban or rural, it's smaller big.
Right, and that's kind of what
yeah.
It is. And so that's something, I think that even when we were working on the rural pharmacy piece,
at the end of the session.
Yeah.
You know.
It was a struggle because we're looking at 40% of the legislators are rural and 60 are in metro. And so I always have to come up with a reason to do this.
Mm-hmm.
Because in that world, it's different.
And I think that, you know, we're a good example of working together.
That's right. Yeah. And that's why I so appreciate it.
Because I think, you know, from my perspective, you know, as a legislator, as a nurse, it's really important that people have access, right, to care. And so we can't close our eyes to the effect that this might have on access for people in greater Minnesota, in rural and small communities. They're too important to us.
I have to chime in with Mark here, but we serve five counties, Union County, Kansas County, Lawson County, some very, very poor counties. Access would be an issue if one village drops in the service. Our Motley Pharmacy is in a county of 600 people, Woodger is in a county of 400 people. You don't put pharmacies in small towns like that. We're there to service the people. Do that best that we can, but if we don't have an income or continue to have a loss, they're not going to be there. And then we serve Brainerd to Wadena and Pine River to Bertha here, and that's a large area. It's great to be there for the clients and the patients, and that's what we love to do, but we can't be there.
There's a question behind you.
Yeah, I'm Pete Park Babbitt, and I was just going to try to answer your question really quick about, you know, how many people are involved. How much of your business is involved in it? And like you said, you know, when the Part D came in, anybody who was eligible for Part D was on medical assistance, so went to Part D and actually got the money that he was paid for. And so my business went down about 8%, just like he said, he was dead. And quite frankly, you know, if our business goes to a loss, you know, it's just a small percentage. People aren't going to subsidize it. People are just like, we're just going to forget. We have Walmart open in town this year in Park Campus. They didn't take medical assistance for that exact reason. So, I mean, people aren't going to take one either. You know, nobody's going to want to ask people's bill costs.
Thank you very much. That's real clear.
Thank you. There's something else that none of us brought up this morning. I went to our accounts receivable manager yesterday. As you are all aware, again, Medicaid recipients may refuse to pay a copay. So I dug back into our archives, and we track all of that. And from January of 2006 through the first 4 months of April, the first 4 months of this year, 2007, we wrote off $56,000 in bad debt that we could not collect. Because a Medicaid recipient can say, no, I don't want to pay that $1, $3 copay for a brand. I'm not going to pay it, but you got to provide me with that drug. So there's another expense that's never been factored in. One other thing that I wanted to mention was that the comment came out of DHS that maybe what the department should do is look at going to managed care and just turn this all over to one of the PBMs, whether it's Prime or Medco or whomever. So I did another little analysis yesterday, and I ran margins on $200 million worth of sales. So again, these aren't trumped up numbers, and it's not just a little piece of the pie. And I compared the state of Minnesota Medicaid rates against Prime Therapeutics, which is aggressive on their national plan. And you guys know all of these. All of the Medicare Part Ds, which are eating us alive. Medco, Caremark, and Express Scripts. The big ones that impact every single one of us in this room today. And of all those plans, Medicaid in Minnesota had the least amount of gross profit building that I except for one other plan. Now, when I bundled them all together and left Medicaid out of that, the ensuing gross was, Medicaid was actually 1.8% lower in margin. So they are already below what the majority of big third-party plans are on the private side that we are reimbursed for. So the comments that their rates are so much better than the rest of the third party, that's a bunch of bunk. Simply not true. And I have numbers,
that you'll share
$200 million dollars that I'd love to share with you.
Thank you. Thank you for that.
So there's been a lot of falsehoods thrown out, a lot of ambiguities, and a lot of non-factual statements that are just simply pulled out of the air. I dug into it. These are the numbers. And for every one of us in this room, I would bet you any amount of money the impact is all the same way. Maybe a fraction of a point here and there. But if you throw it all into the wash tub, at the end of the day, it's going to come out.
Do you think that's because of the impact?
No. I factored all that in.
The Medicare was usually 2%, you said you 1.8.
Oh. Yeah.
So you keep 2% on your rate at the bottom of the risk. Right. But you really have to count the 2%. You know, because I mean, that's
it's an expense. Until that changes, until the legislature will take that away and not force us to pay that as one of the health care providers, it's an expense.
It gets passed on every dollar.
Right.
It gets passed on
to the center.
Right.
Well, it's not just you're not paying 2% on the 30 pills that you're dispensing. You're paying 2% on the bottom 100 Zyprexa.
And the other 70 on the shelf.
And the other 70 on the shelf.
And I understand that. I mean, I understand the 2%, but you know that 2% does take care of.
Oh, it helps.
So if you have a debt, if you're in balance, do you get health care?
Right.
Which isn't the best, but it's something, or do you... I mean, at one point, I know we did some work and 60% of the health care in Todd County was Minnesota care. So I have to...
I understand, but
we always have to weigh...
Too many times that Medicare tax is not really factored in to the costs. It's kind of
something under the radar, but 2% is supposed to be dealt with as health care, and sometimes it's borrowed for other things.
Okay.
Not
that
I was thinking with a group of clinicians last night, and the provider tech came up there as well. And I understand, I really appreciate the recognition that it is an expense that is here for a while. I understand. Pardon me?
You know, there's a lot of dollars. Gross dollars are expected in the provider tech. It's an excess of $60 million, isn't it?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, and the thing is basically, you know, what it is, it's, to me, in a lot of ways, it's an excuse to keep legislators from reprioritizing other spending.
It's hidden, that's the problem.
Well, the other thing, you've got a pool of money, you figure out how to best use it. But when you don't want to give up this and don't want to give up that, then a lot of times right away you get the pharmacy gets shorted. And then you want to add a tax on providers besides. Now, why would you tax the people who are providing the service?
Well, I think
you usually tax the people that purchase the service.
Just to answer that, and I spend a lot of time talking about the provider tax. We've got just about 10 minutes left. But I think, and I wasn't a legislator at the time, were you? The reasoning behind that was that part of the goal of Minnesota Care at the time was to try and slow the growth in health care. So they wanted to take... They wanted to find funding within healthcare expenditures on it, which is the reasoning behind it, to try and not continue the inflation spiral up. But I think you're right, it's here for the time being.
And it's working people that this is the people that are working without healthcare. So we have to balance. And in our rural areas, you know how many people have insurance. It's a lot.
You know, I'm shy about that. In my pharmacy, I only got about 2% of the cash. Those are the only people that actually pay in that price. I have 2%.
I am wondering if you have advice for us.
Well, I see that there are some more people that came.
Okay.
And I'd like to know who they are.
Greg Anderson, pharmacist in Las Vegas.
That's real great. I'm just glad you're here. And then Nicole Valentine, I represent the National Association of Chambers.
Okay, thank you. I'm wondering if you have advice. You know, we've talked a little bit about the federal change. You know that we're doing some work in the legislature to try and mitigate the harm. But you talked a little bit about the overall system, the rebate, et cetera, which, you know, that's a little further upstream than the funding of pharmacy. And I wonder if you have advice for us about that, that concept before we close up today. Yes.
Well, do you know if the rebates, do they go back into the pharmacy reimbursement, or do they just get otherwise, or, I mean,
they go into the general Medicaid pot for pharmacies. But, I mean, I think it would be good to have a specific work group meeting on understanding how those rebates work. Because I think it is a little bit murky, and I think it would even be good to understand. One of the questions I've never been able to answer is federal law requires state Medicaid programs to be able to access the best prices. And that's the bottom line. And my question has always been, if you give a portion of the state Medicaid population to managed care, how is it that they would be able to compete with the pricing that the state Medicaid program could get? And I've never been able to get an answer on that. So I think that would be something good for the committee to explore, especially when the question is raised if they should give it all to managed care. I think it would be really hard to even consider that without understanding that question fully.
As far as rebates go, isn't it the federal government who collects them and gives them to the state?
Well, the federal government sets the rebate rate. The rate of rebate that the manufacturers have to pay, but then the states also, aside from that, are able to negotiate supplemental rebates depending on what choices they make with regard to employment. So I think, you know, just a one-on-one on how the pharmaceutical rebate program works would be a really good idea for all of us.
Okay. Other thoughts?
Well, I talked earlier about how we need rescuing, and the difference is that with Medicare Part D, it was a little bit unforeseen. The formula was supposed to be there for us to get reimbursed, but it didn't happen, and so we went to actually the governor signed off to allow us to get state funding. In this case, it's foreseen, and if it comes down to the time where lack of action. We're in the same situation with Medicare Part D, but we can see that this one's coming. You know, this one is something that isn't unforeseen. And so I would be a little disappointed if some action didn't happen before it actually gets here. Because this is it could be a crisis just as much as the Medicare Part D, where nursing home patients pharmacies were not refusing to provide services to nursing home patients when that Medicare Part D fiasco happened. The governor has to do something, mainly because the nursing homes are raising so much debt. And it's going to be a similar situation unless we take care of it in advance. And that's my recommendation. And I don't know, have all the answers about how you do that,
yep,
other than it needs to be taken care of,
yep,
in advance.
Right.
We should know, I would say, by the end of December what the numbers are going to look like.
Okay.
And DHS is required, based on the legislation that you worked on last year, to report you on the difference between the current Minnesota MAC list and the new federal upper limits that are coming out. So then we'll have to work quickly to address it before the deadline.
But we're here. We really are here because of the work that occurred two sessions ago, Pharmacy Association, and last session, and the chair of our committee, Representative Tiefen, understands that there is a problem that we should be trying to solve.
Well, that's not long, but we knew there's going to be a problem.
Right.
And that's what,
right,
I'm saying.
Right.
If it comes to the time where the problem is here, we have to know what's happened. That'd be
unfortunate.
Unfortunate.
It was. And
maybe everybody knows this, but can you talk? It says January 30th, 2007. And then based on October AMPs.
Yeah.
So we don't go into session until the middle of February.
Mm-hmm. Oh, right.
So
right.
We need to look at this
potentially before. Part of the other complicating factors in that is that there's two federal bills in play right now that may further change things. So I just think we're going to stay on our toes.
Yep.
The whole time between now and the middle, well, implementation, when the pharmacies actually see the effect would be January 30th. That October 1st date is when the manufacturers have to first give the data to CMS for them to create the federal.
What federal government?
You know what? I'll have to get those to you after.
Because I wrote, I mean, when you guys sent out the same to FTHA, which is going to follow up on most of all of these issues, and you give us most of all the representatives and medical letters, and I can make a copy of this, but this one was the CM22381, which was the, I think, like, the federal one of one of the journals they were asking for pharmacists to send.
Hey, Cole, do you know what those global numbers are?
No, I'm sorry, I don't.
I'll follow
up. I have a Senate one from 1954, and we were asked to write this on the return.
Okay.
One question as far as the complications of the timeline, just to keep in mind, I know Iowa, when they looked at this issue, and they did have language in the budget that passed this year, and it was to retroactively affect the rate that they gave the pharmacies back to a certain date. So that's not optimal, but something you could keep in mind as well.
Could you give us a copy of the language?
Absolutely, sure.
You know, when you have a small one-person pharmacy, it's really very unrealistic to try to go back.
Right. I completely hear you on that. And we tried, actually. That was part of the fight that we had during the session, is to figure out if we can't prospectively fix this problem, then when the problem goes into effect, can we be prepared and get the commissioner to the authority to be able to do just what you described? And we were unable to convince the department of the value of that at the time. So, I mean, we're really out here just so that we have a better understanding from the ground about how this is going to affect people, so we can be even better compelling advocates than we were in that session.
Commissioner, I'm not too concerned about this either. I know we hear a lot of it coming from Chris Young's office, but the commissioner of the same mindset.
I can only say that we haven't been able to talk. I have not spoken with the commissioner directly on this topic. I can only imagine that Ms. Young is working under the direction of the administration.
I'm a little disconcerted because I went back and looked at the HHS bill that passed last year. We shouldn't even be here right now discussing the money that we need to fix this reimbursement because there was an amendment offered last year, okay, by Representative Demmer that would restore $25 million to pharmacy reimbursements this biennium and $25 million next biennium.
Right.
Okay. And the thing is, when it came up for a vote to attach it to the omnibus bill, it was defeated, and significantly defeated. And what disappoints me is that both of you voted against the amendment to put this money into pharmacy.
That's because we were working to try and take the money, to try and get the money from the department. Not pour new money into it.
No, this was not pouring new money into it because this was realized from savings.
No, the bill that we worked on was... Right. It was taking money from one program to fund it. We were trying to fund it from within the Department of Human Services from the savings that were going to come from.
But the thing is, there was $50 million of savings for encouraging people to opt from one program to the other. They weren't taking benefits away or giving them. No, they weren't.
Well,
Right, but you look at it this way too, though. But you at the same time, there was $30 million. In the next biennium, and $40 million in the following biennium added so that the majority caucus in this bill could extend welfare benefits to people beyond the 60-month federal limits, and they needed money to fund that.
It's
a fact that's in the bill. It doesn't matter if one got paid for the other. The thing is, you added all this money for something to go beyond the federal limits that were not reimbursable. At the same time, we didn't get that money applied to pharmacy. I just would ask you the next session, when a bill comes up that's as clean as this amendment was, to please vote for it next time.
Well, I would
First of all, it's a 500-and-some-page bill. And this was TANF money. TANF money is needy families money. We did look for new money, and we did work on the rural piece with the pharmacist. And like I said, it's a 500-and-some-page piece. And I sit on finance, but I don't work as hard on that as you do. But we always have to. We had already worked on a piece with the pharmacist, and I think that when TANF money is there, it's to be used for TANF, quite frankly.
When the money was there for the department to capture and do what we were asking them to do, they were backfilling what they were losing in drug manufacturer rebates with the cuts to pharmacy. So, the way that we were
right, but
the money was in fact there for the department
right.
to offset.
But I don't buy the 500-page argument, because the thing is, this amendment, which is a very crisp and clear amendment, was not 500 pages. I'm just saying, in the future, I would encourage you to vote for pharmacy, vote pharmacy-related amendments.
It's
kind of prioritizing. We can have the argument all day.
I think
you better prioritize.
The money that you're talking about that was in the clean amendment that you're describing is federal money intended for a purpose. And to use that money for another purpose would be the same as taking money out of the health care access fund and spending it on roads. Okay? We worked very hard with the Pharmacy Association to find a solution to this problem that was fiscally responsible. And I know that sometimes in the heat of debate there are efforts to try and simplify what is a very complex issue. And I think the amendment that you're describing is exactly that. It's a simplified solution to a very complex problem, and one that wasn't going to work. You have our support to try and solve this problem. And the one thing that I heard loud and clear when I ran for office is that we should be trying to solve the problems of Minnesotans and not spending time trying to divide ourselves. And you have my commitment, and I am sure you have our commitment, that we're going to try and solve this problem the right way and not try and split ourselves over priorities.
That's what I'm asking. I'm just saying, my argument is prioritizing. Marielle, just let me finish, please. When the federal government says you have the welfare recipients, this has nothing to do with Medicaid, this is like two whole different things, but it's just an overall philosophy of prioritizing where we spend extra money. You have 60 months, 5 years, under the federal guidelines, reimbursable, to find the jobs to be off welfare. And the majority caucus last year said, well, we want to extend that. We think 5 years is too short to get off welfare. And so that's where the $30 million in new money came in this biennium, and 40 in the next. I'm just saying that I think rather than looking at extending beyond federal limits, I think if we're going to add money, we should, my thing is I'd like to see it added into the pharmacy program. And then this can be done through the reimportation. Because, you're going to drop your cost down to 30% of what you're paying now.
We did do something for pharmacists at the end, and I took a lot of heat on it. But it passed. And so, I hope that you acknowledge that you do need something.
Oh, you do. It's a question of where we spend our money.
Thank you. Yeah. I appreciate it. I do. And I'm glad you shared your perspective.
I guess I have a comment when I work in the food service off the inpatient website on Festival of Walmart and their $4 program. The rural independent pharmacies are not Walmart. We're pharmacies, it's just very people.
Either are a small
chain. $4 and I just hope that you know, the other people that you talk with and talk about metro and rural, and that they realize that not every pharmacy is a Walmart. We don't have the capabilities of making up for those losses in other areas. So that was just kind of one of the important things, too, that they don't compare all of us to.
We understand the difference.
Does the store have predatory pricing laws on the books?
We did.
How do you stop that?
We did have them.
Well, they're still doing their
Walmart, and I'll be as blunt as I can be, they're making a 4 out of 5.
I think they had to adjust both Walmart and Target had to adjust their list for the ones that they're actually losing money on. They had to discontinue.
But you got to define what a loss of money is, and that includes the professional side of that, not just the cost of
it. So just based on cost, they have to adjust their national list isn't the same as the Minnesota list.
I want to thank you all so much for your time. And we promised we would do this in an hour, and we're almost 7 minutes over. So I want to conclude. I want to let you know again that you are... Our doors are wide open to you, and we are very committed to solving this problem, and we're very grateful for your time and your stories and your willingness to share with us your concerns so we can take them back and actually try and address the issue before it blows rural pharmacies up.
I'd just like to say if either of you would like to come and visit our pharmacy and see what we do on a daily basis, it might give you a better perspective of... You know, I'm sure any of us would love to have you do that.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Graham, that's good.
Liz does a great job for you. That's when good. I need to know what I'm doing on an issue, I go to Liz. I sit on the Rural Health Advisory Board, and she's always there taking a look at what we're doing, and I appreciate that. And I can't tell you again how much I appreciate that you are here. And hopefully some of you, the students, will look at coming back and being a pharmacist in rural Minnesota. So.
Thank you for hosting us today. Thank you very, very much. So with that, we're adjourned. Thank you.
And anytime you want to contact us, please do, because we do listen.